This is Caroline Cape, and today I'll be interviewing Judge Paul Isaacs, past public advocate for the Department of Public Advocacy. We are here in Judge Isaacs' office today in Georgetown, Kentucky. It is September 13th, 2012, and this interview with Judge Isaacs is in regards to the history of the DPA, as well as his involvement and experiences within the agency.
Judge Isaacs, tell us a little bit about your career work.
You mean what I've done since I've been an adult?
Yes.
Okay. Well, after I graduated from law school, I worked for a couple of years with the University of Kentucky, trying to set up a program where law students and architecture students worked on projects in eastern Kentucky in rural areas, poverty areas, to help those in that area. We tried very hard to get a program set up. It wasn't successful, but we did get some people who were, got a one person who was a Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy. I can't remember what they called him, but he got a grant from the Kennedy Foundation to work down there. And but that's the first thing I did, and I was housed in the architecture school, so on my resume it says I was an instructor in architecture, and everybody says, what do you know about architecture? I know nothing about architecture, but that wasn't my role there. After that, I went to work for a program that provided attorneys for juveniles in 16 counties surrounding Fayette County. I worked there until the public defender system started, and then I came to work for the public defender system January 1st, 1973. Worked there until, I can't remember the dates too well on these, but then I went from there to the Justice Cabinet as Assistant General Counsel. Eventually became General Counsel of the Justice Cabinet, then came back to the Public Defender's Office as Public Advocate. Was there from 83 to 91, I think. Went back to Justice as General Counsel, then became Secretary of the Justice Cabinet, Commissioner of State Police, and then became left there after the Jones administration. Went to Administrative Office of the Courts, became Director of the Administrative Office of the Courts, retired from state government, and ran for judge. And that's where I am now. So you can see I can't keep a job.
And you're judge of over what counties?
Scott, Bourbon, and Woodford, the 14th Judicial Circuit.
Okay. How did you become the public advocate?
I was appointed by Governor Brown. That was a first, I think I was the first one that went through the commission process. Maybe the second one, I can't remember. But anyway, it was recommended. Well, I was one of the names recommended to Governor Brown. I was appointed by Governor Brown to serve as public advocate.
What made you want to take on the responsibility?
Well, I'd been there when it first started. I was third, I think. Bill Ayer was first, Dave Merle was second, and I think I was the third attorney hired in the public defender system when we first started. And had seen it develop, but always had a great interest in it. It was interesting. When I was in law school, one of my good friends in law school was a man named Larry Greyhouse. And we talked about how much we needed a public defender system in Kentucky and law school, and what a great thing it would be. Larry, well, very wisely ignored some political advice I gave him, and got in very much involved in the Wendell Ford campaign, and became Wendell Ford's general counsel, and was very instrumental in working with Governor Ford to get the new public defender system started. So I went to Larry and said, I'd like to be a part of that, and he helped me get a job. So I had a great interest in this, and I wanted to see it work. I thought it was important. And everything that in my career, I've done a lot of things, but I still think, know, and realize that for the system to work, you have to have good attorneys on both sides who are dedicated to the pursuit of justice, and you can only have that when both sides have resources. And it's important that the defense have good resources, good attorneys. And I wanted to make sure that that system continued, and it did well.
What was your vision for the department?
Well, I would say the broad vision was to make sure that everybody in Kentucky was brought into court for potential incarceration or involuntary hospitalization or whatever denial of their liberty has an attorney who is a good attorney, effective, and represents them to the fullest ability under the law.
What was the biggest challenges that you faced?
Well, there's always, in government, you learn to operate with limited resources. So they don't coin money just to make sure you have enough money. So there was always a resource problem. At the time, we had contract attorneys, we had full-time attorneys. There was a problem with getting adequate pay for the contract attorneys to make sure that they were adequately compensated for their work, and they weren't. And a lot of them did this more out of a sense of duty than for the pay. And I wanted to make sure that they were adequately paid. I wanted to make sure that the attorneys who were working full-time were paid a good salary, a salary commensurate with their education, so we could get the best and the brightest in the public defender's office.
Who were your political supports or enemies?
I don't know that I had any enemies. If they did, to be honest with you, I never truly tried to concentrate on that. You can't worry about your enemies. You have to develop your friendships, and you have to. There were legislators who understood what we were trying to do, were committed to it. They were helpful. Senator Maloney was very helpful. He was the head of the budget committee. I never had any. I always had bosses ahead of me. I was under a secretary who were supportive and who tried to advance our cause, even though some of them really didn't. We were sort of an anomaly. We were in public protection, and we weren't like anybody else that they had there. But they were supportive. The governor's office generally was supportive, although they were not as directly related. There was one layer between me and the governor's office, so that wasn't as much as some of the as I had contact in later times. But I think certainly the commission was always very supportive. The bar was supportive. I think sometimes you had to explain to individual legislators why this was important. I never looked at them as being enemies. They're just people who didn't understand the process. And so I've tried to approach it with trying to make them understand why this was important rather than making this sort of adversarial. You know, I would always get the question, well, why should I pay for a criminal's lawyer? Well, that's not, you know, you can take that as something somebody's saying that really fighting you, or you can say this person just needs to understand. And so that's the way I tried to approach it, and we did okay, I think.
What program changes or organizational changes did you make during your term?
I think there were a couple of organizational changes. If I remember correctly, we changed the structure of the trial attorneys. I think we first looked at some regionalization, if I remember correctly, trying to get some structure in that, and also the regional attorneys would have a role with not only their full-time offices, but the contract attorneys in that area. That's the biggest change that I remember off the top of my head. He was there. He could probably tell you more than I can. He's younger. He can remember better.
Of course, I know there was limited funding.
Always.
And the workload realities. What were those like during your tenure?
All of anybody who worked in the public defender system, the full-time people and the contract people, both had heavy caseloads. I mean, you know, the reality is that the vast majority of people who come into court in our criminal justice system do not have resources. And so the public defender system gets the majority of them. And so there were many problems with the caseload. I have always been frustrated, and we tried to address this some way when I was there, and it's never been successful because the institution is developed and you can't really fight it. I don't think we count cases right in this state. We never have. And that's not the public defender's fault. It's the court system does it. The prosecutors do it. Everybody does it. Because the only reason they do it, it's easy. And if you just count cases, you really don't know what's going on. The truth of the matter is, what you're saying is a DUI or an alcohol intoxication has the same value as a capital case in one. Well, everybody knows that's not true. But we make all of our decisions based on that because we all count cases. They do it. And every place I've said, we really need to take the time and sit down and do a weighted caseload. We tried to do that, but we never could get enough money and information together to really do it. And even if we had, the problem was we would be judging ourselves by a different standard than everybody else was judging themselves. So it would put us at a disadvantage. But really, if anybody, and I'm sort of preaching now, I'm not giving you oral history, it would be worth the state's time and effort to go back and give somebody the responsibility of looking at in terms of public defenders, prosecutors, judges, and resources. But I don't think it'll happen because the other way is just too institutionalized and too easy. Enough of that. We'll move on.
Was you ever able to make a stab at it? Or
We tried. We tried to do some work on that, and it became obvious that even if we were able to develop that, it wasn't really going to help us to get more funding, and so you can only swim upstream for a certain amount of time, and then you realize that it ain't going to work. So we didn't follow through.
Let's see, what are the memorable cases that took place while you were?
Well, there was a lot of death penalty work in that time frame, and they were the cases that, you know, there were a lot of trying to find attorneys for death penalty cases was difficult because private attorneys did not want to get involved because the pay was abysmal. We didn't have the resources in our local offices or in Frankfurt to cover all the criminal capital cases. Trying to balance all of those things and trying to get adequate counsel for those cases was a very difficult process. I know later you were going to ask me about the Capital Resource Center. That's one of the things that we tried to do to answer that problem. those were the cases that were the ones that took an inordinate amount of time because just what I spoke about, trying to find an attorney, trying to get a competent attorney. Judges were down my throat about, you need to get a lawyer down here. Lawyers were not willing to do it. I will have to say, in some cases, particularly a case in Paducah, where the judge ordered me to jail because I didn't have an attorney for there, and nobody would take it. And an elderly member of the bar, who was a very competent, and sorry, I can't remember his name off the top of my head right now, who had practiced law for many years and had been a very experienced criminal defense lawyer, called me up and says, Paul, I'll do it for free. And those were the type of things that made you proud of the legal profession, because he stepped up to the plate and he took it. It was a very difficult case. This is sort of a side issue, isn't it? There's a picture over here with Ed Johnstone, who's a federal judge, the warden and deputy warden of Pee-wee Valley, Barbara Jones, and myself. I was no longer public advocate, and I can't remember where I was. I think I was in the Justice Cabinet. They had a little ceremony about the prison litigation involving Pee-wee Valley, and which I was involved in representing the state, and Judge Johnson presided over it. And so we were all up there, and at that thing, there was this woman came up to me and said, I've never had a chance to thank you. I said, and she was the defendant in that case in Paducah. And she said, you stood up for us when nobody else would and got us a lawyer. So, that's sort of a neat thing.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the development of the Capital Resource Center.
Well, if I remember, that was a grant that we got from the feds. That came out of the, I think it may have come out of the federal courts budget, because the federal courts were getting a lot of habeases about capital cases, and they wanted to try to do something to make sure that they had better lawyers. Ed Johnstone, I think, was one of the people who helped us get that, if I'm remembering correctly. But I know it was a grant that we got from the federal government. It may have come through the Justice Cabinet or through the court system, but the federal courts were very much involved in making and trying to get these things set up at the state level, and the ABA was involved in it, and we had a good reputation despite resources of in the forefront of capital cases and trying to find competent attorneys. And so we were one of the few. I think there were just a few states got the grants first, and we were one of them. We were one of the few to get one.
In December of 83, there's an interview in The Advocate that you had where you stated one of your primary objectives for the 1984 General Assembly was the passage of the Bill of Rights for the developmentally disabled legislation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that, you know, one of the responsibilities of the department that it had expanded while I was gone and that was there when I came back was providing assistance to people with who were developmentally disabled. That was another part of the department. And it was not just providing lawyers, it was also providing people who would assist family members in dealing with creating plans with the schools and developing alternatives to a hospitalization. There had been realization that just putting people with developmentally disabled, mentally people with lack of development in the mental areas in institutions and just warehousing them, we're just trying to get alternative services for them, make sure that they get competent education, that they get the education services that they need. So we were trying to, that was a very important part of our job. And when you get into it, at that particular time, you found that there were several large institutions in this state that were sort of warehousing these people. And there was there had been some litigation that raising the issue of whether they were entitled to counsel before they were placed in institutions, and the federal court ruled that they were. So we wanted to make sure that we got the resources necessary to provide that representation, that there was some clear rights that they had to address their issues as developmentally disabled, and so that we were trying to get that passed. And I think we did get funding for representation.
A month after taking office, you had an interview in the Advocate where you said that you say one of the most important goals you hoped to achieve was to narrow some of the division you saw between full-time public advocates and the private bar. Tell us about your efforts.
Well, I always thought that the public defender system's biggest advocate should be the bar. Number one, the whole system was created to make sure that you couldn't be forced to represent someone for no pay, which had been the law in Kentucky for many years. And lawyers were, you know, subsidizing the criminal justice system in a way that was not equitable. Now that we have the system, that doesn't mean that they no longer have any responsibility. They're still lawyers, and as a lawyer, I've always taken the position, and I was taught this in law school, that being a lawyer is a privilege. It's a privilege granted to few people, and with that privilege comes a responsibility to protect the justice system, and that means the criminal justice system too. So I think lawyers have a strong requirement that they be committed to do that, and one of the ways they can do that is to help the public defender system. We're dealing with a mixed system. We're dealing with private attorneys who are doing these cases, which, by the way, I think it's always good to have private attorneys for one really important reason. I'm an anomaly. Not too many public defenders are elected judges. They normally come from the private bar. If your private bar is not involved in the criminal justice system at all, you're going to have judges who know nothing about the criminal justice system when they become justices. Now, that may be good in a way because it's sort of like a tabula rasa and you get to write on a blank slate. But I don't think it's a good thing. I think that they need to be aware of what the duties are and how important it is to treat people fairly and justly. And that understand people's rights. So I think it's important, and I'm glad to see that the department continues to use them in conflict cases, because I think that's important. I would hate to see we have only two classes of criminal defense lawyers, public defenders and people who do white-collar crime for big bucks. What I was saying, and realize when you interview somebody a month after taking office, you're probably going to get a lot of naive statements because you don't really know exactly, although you think you do. But I was trying to make sure that we had good relationships, that we were working together, that we were on the same page and everything that we did, that they could be our support when we needed it. And they and many times they did.
You have a special interest in juveniles. Tell us about that in terms of your leadership of the DPA.
Well, we were able to get some extra funding one time because I was able to convince the legislature that we needed more funding to provide counsel for people in juvenile cases and use the enactment of a new juvenile code to say that and to get that. So that was, and I had worked with the people who had developed the new juvenile code and developing the language and everything and participated in that. So I had some way of communicating with them our needs, and that was one of the things that helped us get some increased funding.
Tell us about DPA receiving a grant from the Developmental Disability Council to represent individuals who are labeled as developmentally disabled at sentencing and to provide alternate sentencing proposals to the court in order to divert those individuals from prison.
To be honest with you, I'd forgotten that I knew that at one point we were very interested in trying to find a way to develop alternative sentencing programs. When I sat back and I looked at our representation of people in court, the vast majority of cases were resolved by guilty plea. Very, very few cases went to trial. And actually, today, as a judge, it's even smaller number go to trial. The number of trials has been constantly going down in civil and criminal. So it dawned on me that are we really providing the type of representation that we need to these people that are pleading? Because the real thing in a plea agreement is what's going to happen next? And do we need some resources that can help us develop some alternatives to prison for these people to keep them out of prison, but as a part of sentencing? You know, it may come as a surprise, but I was in government for over 30 years, and from the day I stepped into government to the day I left, the big problem confronting Kentucky was prison overcrowding. It has always been. Everybody's looking for the silver bullet. There is no silver bullet. The Lone Ranger never existed, but they keep looking for it. And I mean, they should. I mean, it's a real problem. So that's the way we approach this. Developmentally disabled people in prison is a very special problem. It's a problem for them. It's a problem for the prison. And it's probably not serving much good to anybody. So we're using those things, we were trying to develop new mechanisms that we can use to help in that particular, and that not only with the development, but also in a broader sense, everybody that we represented to bring a new resource. At that particular point in time, there was an organization called the Sentencing Project in Washington that we worked very closely with, that was very interested in helping defense attorneys develop them. And there were professionals, mostly who worked in the white-collar crime area, who were hired by attorneys to come in and develop alternatives to present to the court for their clients who were white-collar criminals who were trying to avoid prison. I thought, they can do it, so can we. So that was part of it.
What effect did the death penalty representation have on the DPA during your tenure?
Well, it was as I said earlier, it's probably the biggest problem that we faced in terms of resources, trying to find people to, and I think if you look back, there was much more active death penalty litigation at that particular time than there is now. I don't know if the numbers are the same or not, but it certainly seemed to be more intense. And trying to find resources for all of those cases was very difficult at a time when we had not a very much money. And I think the maximum by statute that we could pay anybody was $1,250 for a death penalty case. Trying to deal with those was a major, major problem. It probably consumed, it consumed, I don't know the percentage, but a great deal of my time and the time of everybody in the office.
Was there any issues that you was involved with nationally as far as public defenders or organizations?
The Sentencing Project was probably the one that I was most involved in nationally in terms of trying to educate public defenders and other attorneys about developing alternatives to prison for their clients.
When you left DPA, the defender budget was almost double over the years as you being chief defender. Tell us how you accomplished that increase.
Just developing friendships. I mean, developing relationships with legislators, with people. And I will say that I probably had it easier than some of them. At the time I was in government, there were a lot more legislators who were lawyers, who were starting to decline. I remember when it went, most lawyers made up the majority of legislators, and then it was insurance agents. I don't know what it is now, but I was at a time when there were a lot of lawyers, and they understood the system, and within the political context, they tried to be supportive as possible.
What are you most proud of that occurred while you was with the department?
I don't know that I could say one thing. I think the fact that we were able to increase resources was a very important thing. The fact that we were able to put together a special unit to help in the death penalty cases. I think I'm proud of the representation that the attorneys that I had nothing to do with, but that had gave them a framework where they could represent their clients effectively. One person, Senator Maloney, who was, but when he left the Senate, they had a thing for him in Louisville and Lexington, and he said to me in that speech publicly, he says, "One thing you can be proud of, Paul, is that no one was executed on your watch." I don't know that I can say that I can take credit for that. That was a fluke of history. I think we did a good job, and I think that the attorneys did a good effort to keep that from happening, but I don't think I can say I can take credit for that. I just think I was fortunate.
Paul, when you came to the department, could you talk a little bit about what area you specialized in?
Well, I was an appellate attorney, like almost everybody was. I dealt with contract attorneys all over the state. Especially people that in areas where I happen to know them personally. It's amazing how many people, attorneys I met all across the state that time that I continue to run into. Well, I don't run into them anymore because we're all getting old and retiring and dying and everything, but it was a vast network of attorneys throughout the state that we dealt with. One area that I dealt with more than anybody else in the office, I was sort of the liaison with the prisons. We didn't have offices in the prisons then. In fact, we established the first one when we hired Dave Norat and put him up in LaGrange. But both of the prisons had what they called inmate legal services programs, where they had inmate lawyers who had little libraries, and they operated. And I was sort of the liaison with those offices, and I would go to the prisons and meet with them on a regular basis. I was in constant correspondence with them. One of the interesting things is that developed they had a at that time the prisons in America would ship people around that they thought were troublemakers, and you'd send your troublemakers to somebody and they'd send you theirs. And we got a bunch of prisoners from Missouri at Eddyville. Dave Merle and I developed a friendship with a man that was from Missouri. He was one of our exchange students, as we called him, who worked in the legal services program, a man by the name of Walter Nolan. Mr. Nolan's long dead. But he was 72 years old, and everybody in the office had a relationship with Mr. Nolan, but Dave and I were probably closer, and I have a lot of correspondence that he and I had. I have a copy of all the correspondence that he sent me. I've kept them because they were very special. And he was a very interesting man. He was the son of a lawyer. He grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. He became a pipe fitter. Didn't go to law school or anything. And then he fell in with the mob in Chicago. He was very much a part of that scene. He stood trial 5 times for 5 capital cases. He said, "They never got me." He had a theory. He said, "I always went into court with 2 lawyers, a trial lawyer and an appellate lawyer. The trial lawyer tried the case, the appellate lawyer sat there and watched. He said, if they convicted me, we got it reversed." Very interesting man. And he would sit and talk to me about his days as a member of the mob in Chicago and Illinois. But I remember one letter he said, I was quite wild in my youth. I'm now 72 and very conservative. And he finally got out of prison. He was very good friends with the and I can't remember his name, you probably know the name of the priest from St. Louis who started the Dismas houses.
I don't remember.
And they were very close friends. And when Walter got out of jail, he took him in and they helped him until he died. When he died, he did die. He wasn't in prison when he died, fortunately. But it was a very interesting. But that was one of my first things, was sort of the liaison with the prisons.
You indicated, Paul, that you were the third attorney hired by Tony Wilhoit, mm-hmm. First Public Advocate. Do you call some people hired after you?
I'm trying to remember who was next. Anna was hired after. Anna transferred from the Attorney General's office to Public Defender. Vince came after Anna. I'm trying to think. It seemed like there was somebody between me and Anna.
Joe Gerald, Jim Early.
Early. Joe came a little bit later. Early. Yeah, I forgot about Jim Early, the telephone man. Jim Early was an interesting attorney. If he knew the law, it was an accident. He was not a legal scholar, but he was a good trial lawyer. He was a very good trial lawyer, and he was very convincing of people. And he tried cases by the seat of his pants, but he was pretty effective at it. And he could get on the phone and work miracles. He would get people out of jail just calling up somebody on the phone. It was amazing. He had the gift. He was hired. Jim was hired first as a clerk, and then when he passed the bar, he was around almost from the beginning. He had worked for Tony in his law office before Tony became public advocate.
And do you recall a case or two that you provided the representation in that was particularly proud of?
Well, Vince April and I tried a murder case in Whitesburg where we got a directed verdict. You don't get many directed verdicts in a murder case. But I have to say, it wasn't our great skill as much as it was that they had totally screwed this case up and had not done any investigation. And the kid should have never been indicted for murder, wouldn't have been indicted for murder in most counties. And by the way, was totally innocent, which is the scariest case in the world. And it was a difficult case in a way. His father was in prison. I think his mother was in prison. He was living with his grandmother, and he was accused of killing his grandmother. And the community was very worked up over this case. They had been convinced that he had killed his grandmother, but he hadn't. Probably killed herself, accidentally. He was charged with murder by arson because she died in a fire. And part of the evidence was against him that they had seen him with a gas can a couple days before the murder, or before the death. It wasn't a murder. He mowed yards. That's the reason he had the gas can. And we were able to show, actually, I'm not sure this was it came out because we never had to put on our defense, but we had evidence that he had actually dragged her off the railroad tracks one time in front of a train. So he had saved her life. She was hooked on pills. One of the first cases I've ever seen of that. She was hooked on barbiturates, and she called them the red devils. And she would get up in the morning and pop a bunch of those pills. She was living in a tar paper shack, bare electrical wiring that wasn't even covered. She had a hot plate. She would take sticks of wood, put it on that hot plate till it started smoldering, and put it in a wood stove to start a fire. She had already burned off three of her fingers because she passed out one morning and fell on that hot plate and burned her fingers, and they had to be amputated. We had the medical records. We also had the records of how many pills she had bought from local. They'd been prescribed by a local doctor who was subpoenaed to testify for the defense and was one of the most nervous people you've ever seen in a courtroom. And was probably the gladdest person in the world when we got a directed verdict. He didn't have to testify. She was getting a lot of pills. The other evidence is that they had, during the night of the fire, neighbors had heard her screaming, let me go, don't tie me down, let me go. But nobody could place him in the house that night, and they could not prove how the fire started, because the owner of the house the day of the fire had a bulldozer come in and doze the scene and get rid of everything, because that house did not meet electrical codes. He didn't want anybody to know what was going on. So they could. The reason we got a directed verdict is that they couldn't prove that there was arson. If there's no arson, there's no crime, because it was death by arson. So that's, and Judge Bird Hogg gave us a directed verdict.
What about, what year would that have been?
God, I don't know.
73, 74.
No, it was after that. Let's see, I left in 76. Well, it could have been 74, 75.
And you had a particular passion for juvenile cases. Are there other things that you'd like to talk about in terms of your involvement in creating a juvenile code that was... remains a superior code nationally?
I started out representing kids in juvenile court. That was what I did for 2 years before I came to the department. So I had a real interest in juvenile law. When there was a decision made that they were going to create a group to look at the juvenile code, I was chosen to be on that, and worked very closely with a group of people on that code because they had expressed interest in that area of law and worked in that area of law. I assume that's the reason they chose me. I don't know. And we were trying to get a definitive code that laid out precisely what the procedures were and what the substantive law was in juvenile law, which had been a little vague in Kentucky, and also to write in the constitutional requirements. It had been there for some time to make sure that they were recognized in statutory law. Because one of the things I found out in practicing juvenile law is that not many people, let me put it this way, it's hard for people to understand that. When I first started practicing law, most of the people I practiced in front of, especially in juvenile court, were not lawyers. They had gone to law school. Judges didn't have, the county judge executive was a juvenile judge, and there was no requirement that he be a lawyer. Most of them weren't. In fact, one of them one time when I brought in a advance sheet to show him a case, told me that he wasn't going to allow no magazine law in his courtroom. In other words, if it wasn't in one of those bound books, it was no good. So that was the level that you were dealing with. Now, that changed with the judicial article, and that was another major change. I mean, I always used to say that, you know, I came into the practice of law at a good time, because since I've been a practicing law, we've had no-fault insurance, no-fault divorce, the penal code, the juvenile code, the judicial article. The state of the law when I started and since I've been a lawyer has changed immensely. Every time I take a guilty plea and I go through my colloquy and I start talking about, do you realize I'm not bound by the Commonwealth's recommendation? But if I don't follow the Commonwealth's recommendation, I'll allow you to withdraw your plea. As a young public defender, in the Office of Public Defender, we raised that issue time after time after time with the appellate courts, and we lost. We never won a case on that, but it's now the law in Kentucky. As I read through that, it's always sort of amusing to me. I would say, you know, we litigated that. We never won a case, but it's now the law of Kentucky. So one of the advantages I have is that, being an old fart, is that I can look back and see, no matter, it's not where we want to be, it's not where we need to be, but I've seen a lot of changes and a lot of good changes. And as a judge, I get to see some of those things that we worked so hard and we thought we were losing, we weren't winning these cases, that it just seemed like you were batting your head against a brick wall, but it's now the law in Kentucky. Not because of judicial fiat necessarily, but in a way, because they changed the rules. Eventually the court started saying, yeah, that's not right. It's not right that you play this little charade that, like I used to as a young attorney, tell my client now, they're recommending this, but the judge doesn't have to take it. And if he didn't take it, we're stung. But I got to tell you, when you go in there, you tell him that you've not been promised anything, even though you have been. Because if you say that, it's not going to be good. He can't take your plea if you said you were promised something. You know, it was a charade. And now we don't have to do that. Everything's out front. And so those things may seem not very important in a way, but it changes the way the system works, and it gives it a lot more credibility. So those are the things that I think that really the public defender system probably will never get full credit for. But really, if it hadn't been there, probably some of those things would not have happened.
So you really see that as a contribution to the improvement of justice?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Now, you served under Tony Wilhoit, the first public advocate. Any thoughts in terms of his leadership? He started a program that...
Well, I think he was uniquely qualified because he knew everybody all over the state, and he had a relationship with them. In fact, the fact that he had been county attorney helped, because he was given the job of setting up a public defender system in 120 counties through local fiscal courts. And the fiscal court is represented by the county attorney. And going to magistrates in all over Kentucky and saying, you need to create this system, and we'll help you pay for some of it, but you have to pay for part of it that's going to provide an attorney for these criminals. What? But because of his relationship with county attorneys, those county attorneys would stand up and say, I know, Jim Bob, that's not a good idea, and you don't like it, but if y'all don't do it, we can't prosecute these cases. You know, we have to shut down. Oh, that was very helpful in getting the system set up. His relationship with members of the local bar all over the state, convincing them, agree to do this, step up to the plate. We're not going to pay you a whole lot of money, but you're going to get more money than you've ever gotten before. I think his skills in setting that up were immense and made it happen quicker than I think anybody else could have. He also had, I think, what his vision was, and I think it was the right, even though we're all over the state and we have people who are private attorneys also, we need to consider ourselves as the biggest law firm in Kentucky, and that's the way we're going to operate. And I think that was important to have that attitude. You saw yourself as a lawyer, as a part of a system throughout the state. I thought that was brilliant.
Other thoughts in terms of your leadership or the Kentucky Public Defender Program that you'd like history to know about?
I enjoyed it. I liked it. I worked with good people. It had its frustrations, but I never had a job that didn't. But I never have regretted doing it, and I'm very glad that I got an opportunity